From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are all kinds of reasons, probably thousands and thousands of reasons, why a particular culture in a particular time cared for the bodies of their dead. Could have been a hygiene thing for some. For others, it was based on the belief of an afterlife. The historian Thomas LaCour says, for example, we have no clue why some Neanderthals ritually buried their dead. But his book really isn't about the reasons. He's more interested in why. Why do all human cultures, all of them that we know about, care about mortal remains? And the evidence is all around us. Monuments and relics and keepsakes, songs, lists of names, ashes. LaCour is joining us today to talk about the work of the dead. That's the name of his book. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a long time now, the historian Thomas LaCour has been interested in death. Though it took him a while to figure out just what about it that interested him. In his new book, there's a set of questions he settled on, questions about how death has taken on a social meaning. And it turns out all human cultures throughout time have cared for their dead. Yes, in vastly different ways, but dead bodies have always mattered for some reason. LaCour is with us today to discuss why we visit gravesites and scatter ashes, why we create monuments to the dead, why we sing about them and carry around keepsakes. He describes his book as a cultural history of what real living people did with real dead bodies and what that means. LaCour is the Helen Fawcett Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. His book is The Work of the Dead. We began our conversation talking about his father, a pathologist who did autopsies and examinations of dead bodies, and how that may have influenced his thinking about death.
Well, it's hard to say when one starts thinking about deaths. You know, I think some children think about this as a great mystery from very early on, and I was one of them.
Yeah.
So whether it's because of my father or not, I was a sort of child who imagined could one imagine oneself dead? And then I was really, I couldn't one imagine oneself dead. And I was one of these kids who were interested in Socrates' deathbed scene earlier than kids were, should be interested in
right.
Socrates' deathbed scene. Yeah. So there's a way in which who knows about one's crazy individual psychology. But certainly my father's professional interest in disease and in dead bodies must have affected me in some ways. And I think what it did is give a model for these, for the two poles of my interest. On one hand, my book is about the dead body as a material thing, and that's what my father was interested in. But the dead body as a material thing matters because of the place of death and the dead and the human imagination. So in some sense, I think my interests grow in the one sense out of my father's materialism, and on the other hand, all those things that this materialism doesn't capture.
Yeah.
But I think it would take more psychoanalysis than I have money for it to really get at the root of the question.
Well, then I may not explore this. I have to say, it did interest me that you write that you scarcely reacted to your father's death at the time, and it took you years to kind of absorb it. So maybe we shouldn't spend too much time with that. But you say, to this day, I have no attitude toward it.
Well, what I mean is I have no attitude toward it in the sense that I don't have a view I could articulate. There are hundreds of books which ask you what is the Catholic attitude toward death or the Hindu attitude toward death or some other – what is your attitude toward death? And some people say I welcome it and some people say I'm terrified of it. And so it always seems to me slightly sort of trivial and it doesn't capture the full enormous meaning of it. So when I think about my father's death, when he died – I just didn't psychologically register the sort of enormity of this.
Yeah.
And maybe 6 months later, it suddenly struck me that he was gone. And subsequently, in dreams, he seems to appear. And I tell the story of returning some dirt that may have had my father's ashes in it to Hamburg as sort of a very important moment in confronting his death. But I wouldn't say that any of that is exactly an attitude. It's an evolving set of feelings that I think many people have, and somehow incorporating the dead into our lives. So I guess attitude is too superficial, too thin a concept, to an idea to capture what we actually – what death and the dead mean to us.
At first, you say in the book you were exploring the quote-unquote meaning of death. And
right.
I guess the way you figured it was meaning as an inner experience. But
right.
But eventually you stopped seeing it that way, and you shifted to how death had this social meaning
right.
in the past. I wanted you to talk about that. It wasn't a religious view about death, whether there was an afterlife, all of those kinds of things, but rather, as you put it in the book, how people lived with death, what they did about the dead and
right.
the dying. Would you? Because
right.
this is an important theme in the book.
It's what they did about with the dead body, which I then tried to sort of understand in relationship to the place that the dead had in their lives. So when I first said the meaning of death in this other period, I think that's probably covers some gigantic swath of human experience and human feeling. I mean, what else would be the experience of – the meaning of death is probably comparable to the meaning of love, the meaning of sex. It's hard to know what else – you know, between the two of them, they kind of cover human – the deepest parts of human experience. So in some way, what I'm doing in this book is narrower. Mm-hmm. I'm asking, look, people cared about the dead body and have always cared about the dead body. And though they claim they do it because of this belief or that belief, and in many cases do, in fact, they do it because they're living with the dead in some way, even if they don't believe the dead are anywhere.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so my book is really about the changing – meanings of the dead body in very particular historical contexts. So I want to make two kinds of claims. One is the kind of timeless anthropological claim that humans care about the dead body and always have, because it's kind of – it's a characteristic of us and culture. It's mm-hmm. one of these moments in which we leave nature and we become beings in culture. So
yeah.
that's deep anthropology. And it goes back a long way, possibly hundreds of thousands of years we're now discovering. And the other side of it is that how we actually do it and what we take it to mean changes a lot.
Right.
So I'm trying to balance these two things, the universal on the one hand and the very particular, even the particular in the sense of my own particular mm-hmm. relationship to dead bodies
yeah.
on the other hand.
You write this, that some irresistible power of the imagination, independent
right.
of any particular religious belief, blinds us to the cold reality of what a corpse really is or is not.
Right.
Can you boil that down? What is it? If you, I mean, and well, we're going to
no
break this.
No is the answer.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
750 pages later.
Exactly. But we're going to work through some of the reasons why we
right,
care
right.
about the dead. And
right.
What is that power if it's not religion? What you say, that's not just the thing. It's not just about these beliefs about an afterlife or myths we create. What is it, that thing, that makes us care for or feel with a dead body?
Well, I'm not sure I can actually articulate what is it. I think it's a very deep feature of our humanity. We are probably the only creatures that live in time. That is to say, we imagine a future, we remember or regret a past, and the dead represent that past, and our knowledge of our coming death represents some version of the future, and the fact that we hope to be remembered by someone in that future.
Mm.
So all those things are just features of what it means to be us. And so in some sense, it's like asking about kinship and the incest taboo. Every culture has a different version of incest taboo, but all cultures have some version of kinship. Those are kin and those are not kin.
Yeah.
It's hard to know why. That's just what we are. So that's the general answer. And the specific answer, how I came to this, I do tell the story in the book how I took my father's, I should say ashes, but it probably wasn't even ashes.
Not at that point,
back
right?
To,
yeah.
Not a, well, I know what it was.
Yeah.
But I somehow, I shouldn't even convince myself, I somehow felt that by digging up some dirt from a flower bed in which I had 10 years previously put my father's ashes, which were indistinguishable from the fertilizer I put in, and taking that dirt with some homeostatic the proportion of atoms that might have been from my father, and taking that to my grandfather's grave in Hamburg and mixing with the dirt was somehow returning my father to Germany, which he had fled because of Hitler.
Yeah.
So if you ask me to give you a rational account of this, I couldn't do it, so please don't ask.
Right.
And if my father had were alive and heard about this, he would say this is absolute idiocy and would be kind of shaking his head in despair at his son's irrationality. And so there you are.
You begin with the ancient Greek philosopher and cynic, yeah. Diogenes, because
right.
his proposal as to what to do with his own body when he was finished
right.
with it was yep. outrageous for the time.
Right.
Set this right. up. Establish this context because this is a good starting point.
So Diogenes was a younger colleague of Plato's. And Plato characterized him as Socrates gone mad. And by that he meant that Socrates clearly questioned prevailing customs in his search for truth and actually died in some sense in defense of truth. But Socrates actually believed in some sense in custom and followed custom. Socrates had a proper end. And Diogenes simply rejected culture. So Diogenes was one of the first street people, and he was a forger, and he was a person who rejected, lived outside of culture, claimed to live like animals. So, but he was a very wise man. And so he says, look, the dead body is just a part of nature. And we don't – animal bodies are left around, so we should leave our bodies around. And as he said, when I'm dead, I'm not going to notice the beast devouring me. So why would I want to protect my dead body? So good point. And everyone says it's a good point because that's he's right. It's yeah. No one needs the dead body. It'll just rot like animal bodies or like any other organic matter. End of story. But no one, no culture has ever been able to deliver that. They'll say, right, very good point, Diogenes, but. And my book is really about – or accept. And my book is really all about different cultures' understanding of yes, but or accept then. So in some sense, Diogenes is the real challenge to the dead body in culture. He says it's not part of culture. And everyone says, actually, it is.
Yeah. Well, there's you know? So many examples of why dead bodies matter for us. I mean, the litany that you have in the book is extraordinary. Let me mention a few. You mentioned the sight of the dead unattended bodies right. in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. That absolutely right. sent us for a loop. I mean, it absolutely outraged us.
Right.
Somalia, the bodies of course, dead American soldiers being dragged right. through the streets of Mogadishu.
Right.
That was almost more than we could take. I mean, that shows right. that this stuff does matter to us, I guess.
Sure does. And the Mogadishu thing I think is kind of interesting because it's almost exactly the same motif as Achilles dragging the body of Hector through the plains of Troy. As if the people in Somalia had actually – in Mogadishu had actually read – the Iliad, which I suspect they hadn't. You know, so in some sense, desecrating the dead body and leaving it like that is a horrendous act, kind of basically horrendous.
Even though we understand that soldier is not in that body anymore, his soul or life force or his cells are no longer – even though we know that logically –
absolutely.
It,
right.
it still matters to us.
It still matters. And even in Homer, though, the spirit wanders and so forth. The dead are the bones that the spirit has left. Yeah, we know that and it matters.
You mentioned there are two basic components to the way you break this down. There's the anthropological one, which we'll get
right.
to here in a moment. And there's the historical part.
Yeah.
I think we need to point out, as you do in the book, that there are thousands of explanations about why humans over time have cared for bodies of the dead and
right.
thousands of ways in which humans have cared for these bodies. But your book is not about those reasons.
Right.
You describe the book as sort of a commentary on all of the reasons taken as
right.
a whole.
That's very perceptive. That's you put it better than I do, but it is a commentary on all those reasons. Absolutely.
It's interesting that you would think that anthropologists would be able to pinpoint a time when humans first began to care for the dead. And I guess they probably could, although there must be different theories. But this is interesting to you. In some way, it doesn't necessarily matter to you.
Right. Well, I mean, look, I think when you go, say, 4,000 or 5,000 years before the Common Era, in the first agricultural villages of Anatolia and Kataluyuk, we have really good evidence of people burying their dead under their houses. And we have grave goods with them. And we know these people lived with their dead in this very intimate way in the very first human agricultural communities. And so that's fine. And then we go back into the Neolithic, and we have some evidence. And then we go back to the Neanderthals, and recently we've proved there actually was Neanderthal burial that's been sort of nailed. Yeah. And going back further, we find bones in caves that look like they've actually been scraped rather than gnawed, and that seems to be taken by anthropologists, paleoanthropologists, to be signs of caring for the dead. So as far – we don't know – what percentage of Neanderthals buried their dead, obviously. We find one or two graves of tens of thousands of people, presumably. So, you know, the further back you go, the harder it is to know how many people actually did this. But ritual care of the dead as a feature of humans or hominids seems to go back a very long way. But let me just add, if you don't mind, what interests me more than proving this fact, because I'm not a paleoanthropologist,
right.
But what's important to me is that commentators in most great traditions see the beginning of care of the dead as a kind of origin moment. Hmm. So the Native American stories in which Coyote is dragging his daughter into the land of the dead and is told not to look back. There's a whole story about this, and he looks back. And at that moment, the barrier between the world of the dead and the world of the living was created. And after this came humans. And there are ancient Greek theorists and philosophers who say the pre-Olympic gods ate the dead. But our gods, the Olympic gods, don't. And we bury our dead. And the Chinese sages, 1,000 years before the Common Era, say that we were given names, constitute clans in order to care for our ancestors. So in these great traditions, people way back have claimed that recognizing this limit condition of death and dealing with the dead is a kind of entry into our culture. Before this, there's the world of the animal world, the world of the pre-Olympic gods, some other world. But our world is a world in which we care for the dead and recognize the power of death and the connection between care of the dead and caring for those who are no longer with us. So I guess as a historian, I have more authority in speaking of this long tradition of thinking that way than I am as a paleo anthropologist or paleoarchaeologist.
But I confess I was hoping you would explain, for example, if we have some sort of evolutionary biological aversion, you know, to death, that there, our earliest ancestors, there was some kind of advantage to treat bodies very carefully.
Well, you know, Doug, I thought about this, and I'm not an expert on it, but I spoke with people, and it would have to be some just-so story. I mean, you could say, sure, look, humans do as well as they do because they organize themselves into lasting communities, and organizing some of these lasting communities depends in some sense on living with the dead, on saying we have a past and we have a future. And so in that sense, you could make up a sort of just-so story, and therefore this care of the dead evolved. But we have no evidence for this selection bias in this direction. So it becomes like many of these evolutionary just-so stories, like why do we like music or why do we like art? Now, it's possible that there is a different kind of evolutionary process at work, more or less like the aesthetic choice, like sexual selection, where you think something is beautiful, and possibly this evolved in that way. But I try this book in some sense to stick to my last as a historian and to talk about things for which I have evidence rather than a more speculative evolutionary biology.
Fair enough. One of the reasons we have this gut reaction to dead bodies, you say, is that it reminds us we are, as you put it, on the border of our condition as a living being. The idea, it is of utmost abjection of being cast off.
Right.
Would you talk about that? I thought that was really interesting.
Well, I think most cultures find a dead body abject and terrifying.
Yeah.
Now, why they find this, I don't know, because back in the 18th century before, people said, well, we understand because of the putrid smell that it needs to be ritually cared for. Well, fine, but there's a putrid smell of dead dogs all over the place. No one's ritually burying dogs. So there's some other feature of this feeling of abjection. And I think it speaks to this question of the imagination. I think when people see a dead something that's like them, they're not – they feel in some way that's visceral, really. And that probably is evolutionary, I suppose, visceral, that this is going to be us. So I don't mean to be evasive.
No.
I just don't understand in a deep way what the roots of this. And so it's a little bit like if you were to ask me, so what's the basis of sexual attraction? Well, you can say there are hormones and there's this and that. But it's very hard when you actually are asking some people why this is the case for humans as far as we can tell way back. It's awfully hard to actually give you a precise account. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think it is the case that as people reported, seeing an uncared for dead body is a danger. It's a danger to our security in the sense that we will be this way. It's a danger because God knows where these dead are and they can come back and do something bad for us. It's a danger because they might, as they come back in different forms and do something bad to us. In other words, there are many, many different ways we imagine the dead threaten us. From the psychological that you read, the sort of making us feel at this abyss, to all these other beliefs about the dead returning and the dead causing disease and the dead doing all sorts of things. We care for the dead body for that whole range of reasons,
yeah.
Plus the larger ones about producing a community of our ancestors.
Thomas LaCour, he's a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. His book is The Work of the Dead, A Cultural History of Mortal Remains. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about why we take care of our dead, why we bury bodies and cremate bodies and place gravestones and scatter ashes. The historian Thomas LaCour is our guest, and he says every known human culture throughout time has done something with dead bodies. His book examines why we've ritualized and remembered the dead. The book is called The Work of the Dead. LaCour is a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, and he joined us from a studio at the Graduate School of Journalism there.
There are two ways of looking at dead bodies, maybe not to overly simplify this, but there's in nature and then in culture. In nature,
yes.
A body is organic matter in the process of decaying.
Exactly.
In culture, and this is what I want to ask you about, you say a dead body is a social being who, as you write, needs to be eased out of this world and settled safely into the next and into memory.
Right.
Would you talk about that, this idea that death in culture, as you say, takes time because the social fabric when someone dies is torn a bit and we need to reweave it.
Certainly is torn. Well, think about this. If someone dies, you take their property. You sort of literally step into their shoes. I felt that when my father died, I'm cleaning his closet and using his shoes was a very eerie thing. Partly it's because shoes have this intimate relationship to the dead or to people. So there's a sense in which we in some sense treat the dead horribly, right? We marry their husbands or wives. We take their property. We take their clothes. We do all sorts of things that suggest they're done. But we feel we need to do it slowly. We need time to understand this massive transformation, in part because, of course, someone's going to be doing this to us someday.
Right.
So every culture thinks of this, have these rituals in which someone quits being the social being they were just that moment before they died and becomes another kind of being very gradually.
You write about, in some way, the dead helped to make what we think of as the modern world. It seems ironic because you talk about the fact that the disenchantment of our age. In other words, you would think that in a more enlightened age, a more secular age, an age where we have more clear ideas about science and those kinds of things, that why haven't more people come to agree with Diogenes?
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
And the fact that more people haven't come to agree with Diogenes makes me think that we've become newly enchanted or differently enchanted rather than disenchanted in this version. And the enchantment entails not a belief in God, but belief in this notion of what the dead body is. It's a representation of us in time, as I've said. So let me give you the example of making the modern world.
Yeah.
So in the book, I trace sort of, now speaking of the West, three stages in this. So in the ancient world, the Greek and the Roman world, and families dealt with dead bodies.
Yeah.
And so you bought a plot, or if you were poor, you had a common plot. But this was the issue of families, and you bought tombstones, and this was your project. And they were outside of cities. It was a very clear distinction. So the great revolution in the coming of Christianity, so we're speaking now between roughly the 4th and the 7th century, was that the church gathered its dead around the bodies of the special dead, around the bodies of saints. And somehow, and the theology of this is very fraught,
yeah.
Being near these special dead mattered. And so they moved inside the city where these special dead were now buried. And by the 10th and 11th century, to be a church, I mean, the definition of the church was to have a relic, which means to be some bone or some part of this dead special person. So what I call the necrogeography, that is, the placing of dead bodies, changed radically. And the people who took care of dead bodies changed radically. And I would say the main function of the church, in some sense, is to care for the dead and to be excluded from that space of the Christian dead through excommunication was just the worst possible punishment.
So there's this pagan regime in which it was about families.
Right.
Right. And individuals. And
right,
so
exactly.
when it moves then into the churchyard, it becomes less about families and individuals and more about, and this is how you put it in the book, more about the bounded community of the dead.
Exactly.
So now it was less about the families.
Christian community of the
yeah,
dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Explain that.
Well, it becomes, in a churchyard, I mean, if you're very rich, you could be buried by the 14th century inside the church with your family. But by and large, people are buried where they could be
yeah.
in the churchyard.
Yeah.
It's a community of the Christian dead, that parish,
right.
around a special dead person, a relic. And there are very, very few tombstones. I mean, kings had tombstones and extremely important people had tombstones. But by and large, people are buried as part of a congregation of the dead, if you will.
Right.
And you might think that that would change in the Reformation because the Reformation, the Reformers, made a big deal about – I mean, it was central to them that relics didn't matter
yeah.
and that you didn't need saints for salvation. And so Martin Luther famously says, just bury me in a meadow somewhere. It should make no difference where you're buried. But in fact, the Reformers themselves and their followers were buried in exactly the same way as they had been before the Reformation. That is to say, as a Christian community. So nothing much changed in the Reformation. So that brings up the interesting question that you raised about the modern times.
Yeah.
And what is characterized as, in my view, modern times is the possibility of living in a world or thinking you could live in a world, a cosmopolitan world, where people have very different views, pluralistic views. And our communities are people who come from different places, who go to different places. The question of churchyard burial becomes fraught in the 18th century when famous people like Voltaire and less famous people all of a sudden find themselves threatened with not being buried in a humanly respectable way. The church wanted to exclude Voltaire, and it became a great scandal. And Europeans traveled to different parts of the world, and they died there, and they needed to be buried in some – there were no churchyards.
Yeah.
And foreigners came to different parts of Europe. Protestants went to Catholic countries and Catholics went to Protestant countries and Muslims were there and so forth. So in the modern period, in the early 19th century, we had the creation of the cemetery. And the cemetery harkens back to antiquity. You can buy a place there. It's cosmopolitan. Anyone can be there. Again, they're family tombs. And they were explicitly and self-consciously communities where the Russian could lie next to the Englishman, the Jew to the Christian, the Spaniard to the French. So these were thought of as these cosmopolitan kinds of communities. And they had they went back to a classical necrogeography. They were outside of cities. Mm-hmm. And rather than being around the church, they were parks. And the graves, rather than being oriented east-west, aligned with the church as they were in the Christian cemeteries, were aligned to the view, to the river, to the road, whatever made this park beautiful. And so in my view then, these places become new kinds of civic spaces in which new kinds of communities can make themselves. So that's the general version. So what kind of new communities? Well, working class communities, political communities can create areas of their graves which become in some sense shrines. Secular enchantment might be a word for it, right? So – and in the modern era, which strikes me as sort of really interesting and strange, so the Communist Party of Britain moved Karl Marx's grave from an obscure place in Highgate Cemetery to where it is now at the crest of the cemetery overlooking London, a gorgeous place. It cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And since then, important communists from all over the world have been buried around Karl Marx. And I sort of suggest half-jokingly, you can imagine an archaeologist 1,000 years from now digging this up and saying, who is this strange sect with this sort of bust of this bearded man and all these graves which mention his name being around them? Was he a Sufi saint? Who knows who this man
right,
was?
Right.
And then recently, just within a couple of years, the most important Marxist historian of the 20th century, Eric Hobsbawm, bought a plot 20 feet from Marx and has a tomb that's probably 3.5 feet by 7 feet. I mean, a real traditional 18th century style box tomb. And therein is an urn of his ashes. And you ask yourself, what possible reason could a materialist Marxist historian give for wanting his ashes to be next to Karl Marx? But that's a way in which we say we're making a modern world. We're making a world in which this community of affiliated people can exist next to all sorts of other people.
Well, here's how you put it in the book. You say cemeteries serve the interests not of the old god of religion, but the new secular gods,
right?
Memory and history.
Right, right. Well put.
Yeah, well put. Yeah, that was you. Yeah, I want to back up just a moment because before we move beyond the churchyard is this kind of monopoly on burial, which was the case for hundreds, if not 1,000 years. I do want to mention something because it's a lot of fun reading as you write about the legal cases that played out, these incredibly arcane legal cases dealing with whether or not a young girl who died before having the benefit of baptism should have been allowed to be buried in a churchyard at all. And it's amazing the sort of case law that develops because of these cases.
Absolutely. It's a remarkable story. But the reason it's a remarkable story is – and these are 19th century cases because we're really at the cusp of the end of the old regime. If you think of the old regime in most countries, in England it was called the juncture of church and state. It was some version, crudely put, of a theocracy. In other words, the state and the church are intimately bound up together. And it's not just true in England but in all these old regime states. And that means that the church is control of the dead. And so the breakup of this is sort of a feature of the breakup of the old regime. And I think it's kind of the final moment. In other words, if the church had control of anything, it's control of the sacred space of the dead. And in these pluralistic communities where people like Baptists, in the case, don't get baptized until they're slightly older.
Yeah.
Or they get baptized by someone who's not a regular, quote, clergyman, that is, of the church in the apostolic succession, the Anglican Church or the Catholic Church. And therefore, they're out.
Yeah.
So in the old regime, they were out. They're not part of this community. In the new regime, there's this conflict. Of course they're part of civic society, as you say. Of course they're part of civic society. On the other hand, 500 years of case law say, well, actually, there isn't a civic society of the dead. There's only this ecclesiastical society of the dead. And so that gets fought out at the very highest levels because it's a major sort of constitutional issue. Now, you're right. It seems completely ridiculous. The clergy doesn't want to bury some little girl because she's not baptized. It's crazy. On the other hand, to bury her if she's not baptized is in some sense to give up on 1,000 years of the relationship of the church to the dead and the church to the state.
Mm.
So in some sense, what interested me about this is in what small and crazy way these huge shifts in that would create the modern world come into being.
You write about these big, great cemeteries like Père Lachaise in Paris. Yeah. And then there's a version, of course, I guess different versions, and one in Boston or out
Mount Auburn.
Mount Auburn, exactly. In Massachusetts, yeah. In San Francisco.
Right.
I guess this is when we start to see the beginning of, although at least in this context, memorials and monuments and gravestones.
Exactly. Because if you think of the churchyard, gosh, there isn't very much room. First of all, they're very small.
Yeah.
And, you know, around 1800, maybe 5% of people buried in the churchyard would have a memorial. And then it's a very small space that people kept being buried in, and then there's every 300 years get dug up again. That's the graveyard scene in Hamlet, mm-hmm. and leveled, and it's all lumpy and mixed up. And the cemetery gives the chance to build – it's huge. You can buy a plot and to build memorials. Exactly. And so that's what I meant by the cemetery exists to serve the gods of history and memory. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cemeteries are these gigantic memorial spaces. We also then get the creation of national cemeteries, which become memorial spaces in the interests of nation. Yeah. So they're not only memorial spaces in the interests of civic society, of different groups, but also of the nation.
Well, think about Arlington.
Exactly.
And the place that must hold in our consciousness.
It does. If you go to the Arlington Cemetery website, it calls itself America's most sacred space. Now, whether that's true or not, it is the official government website on Arlington Cemetery. But if you think about this in other contexts, I mean, the romantic Czech nationalists of the late 19th century gathered important Czech poets and composers and artists and other sorts of people in the cemetery, in a new cemetery in Prague, representing the Czech nation in spirit, in culture, before it existed in politics. So lots of places start creating national cemeteries. The first one of ours is, of course, Gettysburg, which – Gettysburg was an explicit replay of the ceremony at Gettysburg, explicit replay of the Greek commemoration of the Battle of Marathon. And so at the Battle of Marathon, the Greeks defeated the Persians, and from the Greek point of view, therefore the values of Western civilization. And at Gettysburg, the Union soldiers, the Union forces defended civilization, that is to say the Union cause, against the South and the slavocracy and the Confederacy, the rebellion. So there's this analog. And so the main speaker at the event before Abraham Lincoln was a president of Harvard and a great classicist and a senator who gave this hour-long speech about how this was like Marathon. And he had visited Marathon when he was a young man, and he had seen this mound where these men who had died defending Western civilization were buried. And as he stands there at Gettysburg, it's the same story. Then Lincoln, and in a much obviously infinitely more brilliant and way and more pointed, repeats a version of Pericles' funeral oration.
Yeah.
Gary Wills, the historian, explicates this beautifully, where he Lincoln is very conscious of Pericles, and Pericles gave this great oration over the bodies of dead Athenian soldiers. So he dedicates this ground. This ground was already dedicated by these dead soldiers. And dedicated to a new vision of what the nation, the United States, was. So there's this repertoire of how we make the dead speak for these great national purposes, Marathon and Pericles on the one hand, and Gettysburg and Abraham Lincoln on the other hand, spanning 2,000 years.
Thomas LaCour, his book is The Work of the Dead, A Cultural History of Mortal Remains. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Thomas LaCour. We're talking about his book, The Work of the Dead.
There's a great section in the book about where you explore names. There's this question you're asking, who are the dead and why we gather names on monuments and memorials. Right. And believe me, I don't go through every book that I – of writers to look for references to Utah, but there is one. And
there is one.
We should talk about this. There's this great short story by the Serbian writer Dana Lokish, Encyclopedia of the Dead. And it's about this man who finds this encyclopedia in a library. Right. And he discovers that it's kept by this sect that had this egalitarian vision of the world and the idea of redeeming the dead And of course, in Utah, there's a real life sect just like this.
Which I'm sure he knows about, obviously.
Right, of course. Yeah. The Mormons, course, who have, as you put it, this great storehouse of the names of the dead. Will you talk about this moment? Because you do write about this interesting, the idea of redeeming the dead and the idea of names, right. This huge, right. 26 billion names or more anyway.
Well, the Mormons are clearly the masters of this. And again, here's one of these cases in which I certainly wouldn't want to deny the religious beliefs which prompt Mormons to gather these names.
Sure.
But I want to suggest that other people, the people that Kiss imagines in a non-religious sense, and all these other people in the 19th century started gathering names, do it at the same time. So in some sense, this aspect of the Mormon religious practice and of what we might call secular practice and other people happen at the same time. And so in the Western world and parts too, gathering names becomes hugely important. And I think I want to try to explain why that's the case.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the Mormon Project is important to me, and versions of it are repeated in other places. And there's this poem of Zbigniew Herbert called Mr. Cogito Wants to Know, which is really about these efforts to list names in a very secular context. So I try to understand the Mormon story as part of a larger development in trying to recover, redeem the dead.
It's interesting. So
the ordinary dead.
The ordinary dead, and the idea is that I think I understand how it works in the sort of the Mormon view, but what's the secular view? The idea that yes, they're dead, yes, they're past, but they still have life within us. We can still reform their reputations or their images.
We can go to where they are, and we can recall them. So obviously, in the Kitsch story and in the naming memorials and lists of biographies that end up in the 9/11 memorial and the Vietnam memorial and all these other memorials, people aren't saying, look, we're going to do this because it brings people into salvation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, these are – I'm not speaking that every aspect of the secular maps onto the Mormons. So in that sense,
sure.
There's clearly a religious version of the Mormon story. But in secular society, I think people start believing I'm interested in the fact that every life has an end that we need to know. So where do we get that idea? Well, I said sort of slightly superciliously, we get it from the rise of the novel. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of silly, but in some sense there's something to be said for that because, you know, in great tragedies in Shakespeare's time, ordinary people don't have deathbeds. And the novel, the 19th century novel, is full of deathbeds of quite ordinary people. So you start understanding that ordinary people have significant ends. And then more and more people, because of communications, because of letter writing and so forth, people know more about the lives of their loved ones. So soldiers dying in the Civil War send letters back before they die. And they've had letters before that. And so there's a real connection between the dead of the war and the people back home. And in many, many, many other realms, we know more and more about ordinary people's lives in the 19th century than ever before. And so when someone dies, they're not just gone, as they might have been 500 years earlier. They're still part of the lives of the living. And we need to know. That's the Mr. Cogito needs to know. We need to know. And knowing is redeeming them. It's bringing them back into civilization. So finding out the names of the undocumented workers who died in the Los Gatos crash in 1948, the Woody Guthrie song, now is an act of redemption. It's an act of bringing these people who were the unnamed, the unknowns, into the world. They're not unknowns. They're real people. They had lives. So that's what I mean by redemption.
Yeah. You explore this question of what are the dead? And this is this yes. really interesting section about ashes. And I have right. to say, I never knew this. I never understood this idea that cremation, modern cremation anyway, at least and in the West, this was begun as a way of stripping death, you say, of its
right.
history.
And it was true of – the Chinese communists tried to do this. It's hard to do, but it was stripping death exactly of anything. Exactly.
You pinpoint, in fact, the there's a doctor, a French doctor, March 29th, 1794. You pinpoint the exact
right.
date.
Yeah, well, he's an Italian doctor writing in French.
Oh, sorry.
You're absolutely right. No, it's silly. It's pedantic of me. So what happens is in the late 1860s, early 1870s, a group of Italians primarily who were, let me give you the list. They were materialists. They were nationalists, which is to say they were for United Italy. They were against the church. They were Freemasons, meaning they were also against the church. By and large, they were also atheists. Yeah. And they were technically inclined. And they thought human progress comes through technology. So they say, look, dead bodies are simply dead organic matter. And we in the modern world have ways of burning them to their components that they didn't have before. And that technology is the modern steel furnace, right. Reverberating furnace. So they did all these experiments, and they found, sure enough, you put a dead body in a steel furnace, and it reduces it to ash, no bone left, or just little chips, in a couple hours. And then they analyzed what that was, and it was so much phosphorus and so much nitrogen and so much calcium. And that's it. And some of them had outlandish ideas. We can actually burn these bodies and use them for energy generation, or we can use these ashes instead of importing guano from Peru. We can use these for fertilizers. So it was just a radical dehistorization, decontextualization of the dead body using technology. And in the early days of cremation, it was very explicitly a sign of one's allegiance to the doctrine of progress. Among Reformed Jewish communities in Switzerland, in Livorno, and various places, a disproportionate number compared to the other population of people, Reformed Jews, had themselves cremated as a sign of their allegiance to modernity, to technology, to science. Now, as it turned out, even ashes never stayed just ashes, even though they're the most distant conceivable from the what we were as humans.
No, we replaced the deference to bodies with the deference to their ashes.
Right, but their ashes are really just fertilizer.
Yeah.
And yet we get very upset. I mean, front page news when I think it was in Georgia a few years ago, someone mixed up ashes of different people, even poor people.
Yeah.
So mixing up ashes, getting the wrong ashes is thought to be terrible. And you still need ashes. That's the thing that strikes me as so culturally mysterious. That shows the power of this idea of we need the materiality of the dead.
Let's talk about how this may all play out in the future.
Oh, God.
Because you mentioned in the book.
You know I'm a historian. You introduced me as a historian.
I know, but you do mention.
We do the past.
I know, but you do talk about that briefly.
I do.
Mentioning the fact that we're entering a new age. And this is how you put it. We're entering this age not of being dead, but of becoming dead.
Right.
And that must throw a wrench in the works entirely. But it doesn't change your theory necessarily, but it does add another element, I'm supposing.
It does add another element. I guess I wrote this last section because I mentioned I teach with a friend of mine, a doctor, Guy Miko. We teach a course on death and dying. And the course has over the years become increasingly about how hard it is to become dead,
how
agonizing these decisions are about when to declare someone dead, how much connected they are to all these other questions. I mean, when you actually talk to clinicians, it's not just pulling the plug. It's sort of, can we keep someone alive long enough for certain legal advantages, for mortgage payments to be different, or Social Security payments to be different? All this is now so connected with everything else that dying is not – it never was a totally natural process, but now it's connected with all sorts of other things about technology and about welfare and about many, many, many things. So I don't know where this is going to go. I would imagine that if one were to write a book sort of like mine 100 years from now, we would have to be dealing with the question of becoming dead. We might even have to deal with this question of life prolongation into the hundreds of years, as some people now propose as being possible.
You write that we have no cultural history to guide us when health and well-being fade and dying becomes a branch of bioengineering. But I have to say, there's a kind of lovely way where you wrap this up with a quote from Atul Gawande, the journalist and doctor, who said, "For now, our hope is to take back dying into the realm of human communities." And it seems like maybe that's a big theme, it seems, that we have these diversions from time to time in human history, but we all try to kind of reorient it and get it back to the idea of making death social again. Is that fair to say?
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's what's brilliant about Gawande's book. And the book makes me feel optimistic about making it social again. Now, of course, you know, it helps in his case of his father, that the father had the son who could make that possible for him. I mean, just to navigate the world of dying. But there's a lot of resistance, and there's a lot that resists the social. This whole apparatus of dying in a hospital, it's gigantic. I mean, there's a wonderful book by Sharon Kaufman, one of the few ethnographers we have about dying in hospital today. And it's so tied in with issues of insurance and compensation. You know that we can't actually officially die in hospital because dying is not a diagnostic category. So if they're not doing something to you, you're not supposed to be there. So that's why it's endless shuttling back and forth from rest homes to hospitals. So it's a battle to re-socialize it. But I think it's possible. But I also think, and I ended the main part of the book this way, I also think that we're going to continuously reinvent how we re-enchant the bodies of the dead. So I don't think my story is going to go away. I just think it's going to be part of a bigger story about how in the modern world we make dying social again.
Because it's not going away. I mean, this
certainly dying will not.
Well, it's probably not dying.
Going away. I mean, some people think it might go away, but I don't think so.
That's not what I meant. What I meant. Sorry, and I didn't put that very well.
Though there are people who believe that dying will go away.
That's true. Our regard for the dead body, of course, is not going anywhere. At least, and you'd think that in some way, maybe that would change, but. You describe yourself – you mentioned the idea of enchantment, you describe yourself as one of the unenchanted. But you say this. You say, I believe the power of the dead has always worked and still does by sleight of hand. But there's a profound thing. There's some kind of magic. You don't have to be a believer, but you understand there is some sort of secular magic at hand here, that's going to persist.
Exactly. I think it's going to persist. I mean, it has persisted. We keep doing it. I mean, 9/11 is the most recent version where we have this whole structure built around these fragments of bones from these people who died. But it's certainly not religious. And it's certainly enchanted. So that's what I'm saying. It doesn't look like it's going away, even in civic and explicitly not religious spaces.
It's Thomas LaCour. He's the Helen Fawcett Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. We were discussing his book, The Work of the Dead, A Cultural History of Mortal Remains. Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover. The show is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.